On Wednesday, the 25th of January 2006, the Palestinians in Jerusalem, the West Bank and Gaza went to the polls for the second legislative elections. The elections took place under the supervision of international monitors, headed by former American President Jimmy Carter. Just as the voters finished casting their votes and polls closed, international monitors braced the election process and described it as fair and free. But the results came opposite to what the appetite of some desired. Hamas was announced the winner with a majority that gave it the power to form the 10th Palestinian government.
In accordance with Article 67 in the political law of the Palestinian National Authority, which narrates that after their trustfulness is proved and obtained before they commence their duties, the Prime Minister and the members of his government perform in front of the Palestinian National Authority President the constitutional swearing provided in Article 35 of the fundamental law. Thus, the Prime Minister, Professor Ismail Haniyeh, stepped forward to take the constitutional oath. In the name of the forgiving, merciful God, I swear in the name of God the Great, I will be loyal to the country and its sanctities, people and national heritage, and to respect the constitutional order and law, and to comprehensively look after the benefits of the Palestinian people. God is the witness of what I say.
Around the world, when a new government is elected, it is showered with letters of support and congrats. As for the Hamas government, it was showered with letters of threats and warnings, and it was sentenced to the death penalty.
The siege is mainly a political move by Israel, the US, and the former Egyptian Hosni Mubarak regime, which participated because it considered itself as the sponsor of the settlement process in the region. Additionally, because the former Egyptian regime thought Hamas is an Islamic movement with links to the Islamic Brotherhood, and that its dangerous effect would reach the Egyptian side and destabilize the political regime that led the settlement process in the region.
In the beginning, the former Mubarak regime involved in the siege of Gaza was represented in the closure of the Rafah border crossing, which is the only port and point that connects Gaza to the rest of the outside world. This port, that is part of the Egyptian borders with Gaza, was subjected to an agreement in 2005 called the Rice Agreement. The most important terms of that agreement included the presence of European monitors and cameras that feeds to the Israeli occupation army so that they can watch everything that happens inside the port.
Israel is responsible for sealing all its borders, including those of the occupied territories, meaning from the north to the east to the south, with our borders with the sea to Gaza. The Rafah border crossing has its story, a long-standing agreement. The agreement is that instead of Israel, there would be a representative from the Palestinian Authority, European monitors, and cameras remotely monitored by Israelis to see what comes in and goes out. Now, after Hamas took over, it kicked out the Palestinian Authority and the European monitors, and the situation became complicated. We are now in a very embarrassing situation. We were trying various methods to find a solution. In order for the Rafah border crossing to be open, there must be Egyptian, European, and Palestinian monitors. The European monitors do not want to attend, and so if we did things without prior arrangements, they'll start the blame game.
Egypt was not part of this formula. The agreement was signed in November 2005 and was valid until November 2006. It was extended by 7 months until July 2007, and it was not extended after that, and so it became null and void. The former Egyptian regime justified its move by saying that opening the Rafah border crossing would turn Gaza into a burden for Egypt. It said because it's the only door to Gaza, opening the crossing would exempt Israel from its responsibility regarding Gaza. Does that mean that we have to bring back the occupation to Gaza again in order to exempt Arab nations from their responsibility to bring Israel to account for the crimes it's committed?
The closure of the Rafah border crossing sentenced the entire Gaza population to live in the world's biggest prison. The size of the prison, 362 square kilometers, population 1.8 million. Gazans' destiny became controlled by the Israeli occupation army and the Egyptian regime.
For a long time, we couldn't reach either Erez or the Rafah border crossing. We were completely locked in. In 2009, after the Al-Furqan war, I was diagnosed with cancer. I managed to get some money and prepare to travel. My brother wanted to accompany me. Then some of my brethren who'd been detained in Egypt returned home, and we went to welcome them. They asked me how I was and how far I had gotten with my treatment. I told them I was ready to travel out of Gaza for treatment. Then they said, if you have a passport, shred it. You won't be able to withstand Egyptian interrogations and torture. If you go there, you'll die.
Abd Allah Abd Rabu took his friend's advice and did not leave Gaza. As for Asma Obaid, the student from the University of Ain Shams in Egypt, she had her own personal story with the Rafah crossing during the era of the removed Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak.
Honestly, the story of our crossing is exhausting. It took me 4 years to do my master's degree because communicating with the Egyptian supervisor was very difficult and traveling was impossible. It was very risky. It was a miracle I could get in, and of course we suffered on the Egyptian side just because we were Palestinians. It didn't make a difference if you were a young or old man or woman. They would treat you as if you were terrorists wanting to enter Egypt. Honestly, I'm not comfortable getting into the details.
If some did not speak about the details of the treatment of Palestinians by Egypt's national security apparatus, Ala Abu Dalal spoke about it, about when he traveled through the Rafah border crossing to perform the mandatory Hajj.
If you spent 2 hours waiting on the Palestinian side, it meant you'd be spending 6, 7, or 8 hours on the Egyptian side. After your passports were stamped, you were taken outside the crossing and then boarded buses under tight security. Then you'd get transferred to Al Arish Airport. Once there, you'd find elderly people lying on the ground with cancer, heart, and other diseases. Patients that the Egyptian side didn't care about. We left the Palestinian borders as prisoners, and when we moved to the Egyptian territories, we got treated just like prisoners. We were put under tight security during the transfer to Al Arish Airport, and all the way until we started our trip to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
That's how the Palestinians imprisoned in Gaza feel when they strike luck to leave Gaza imprisoned in Gaza, but when they cross into Egyptian territory, they also get treated like prisoners. As for those who stay in Gaza, they just try to deal with the chains of the siege by staying alive.
After Israel shut down all of Gaza's border crossings, we resorted to digging underground tunnels between Gaza and Egyptian borders in order to bring in food supplies, including formula for babies in addition to sugar, flour, cheese, cooking oil, and other foodstuff.
According to the United Nations reports and those of independent human rights organizations, the tunnels form the only glimmer of hope in the face of a total catastrophe that nearly happened in Gaza. The tunnels also provided to thousands from the Army of the Unemployed an opportunity to gain their daily wages in a job that often exposed them to death, either due to collapse of the tunnels on them or due to Israeli warplane bombings of the tunnels and the workers, or by Egyptian security officers who often released poisonous gas into the tunnels to intentionally kill the workers.
After the complete lockdown of Gaza, people started bringing in food, medicine, and other necessities through tunnels. And this couldn't have been done by the Egyptians or the Jordanians or anyone else. The mission of bringing in the food supplies had to be done by the Gazans themselves. Only they would endanger their lives to make it happen.
Mohammed was married and had two daughters. Osama was a university student. They went to break the siege of Gaza, so they went to dig tunnels to bring in food supplies and gas for the people. Those things weren't available in the coastal territory. They would carry the gas tubes on their backs. They did it all for the people.
The small holes in the walls of the siege on the people of Gaza irked the Israeli occupation, which declared war on them, bombing the tunnels with earthquake-causing missiles and bombs. But the constant bombings had little effect, which led the Israeli occupation to the sister nation of the Palestinian people, as it might participate in destroying the tunnels and killing those working inside.
The previous Egyptian regime, specifically its intelligence and national security apparatus, used to release poisonous gas in any tunnel they found. The gas killed those down there. Four were killed in only one day by the Egyptian poisonous gas.
Egyptian security forces found the entrance of the tunnel, then vehicles of the explosives unit arrived and opened it and pumped gas into it. Everyone was surprised because several times before they were hit by gas, they were pulled out alive by rescuers. But this time, all the people said it was a different gas. They said it smelled different. About six workers were in the tunnel at the time. Two got out alive and four died, including my two brothers, Mohammed and Osama.
Twenty-year-old Osama, who did not finish school, departed, and his brother Mohammed departed too, leaving behind his two daughters and a wife pregnant with the third.
Mohammed was married and had two daughters. When he died, his wife gave birth to the third. She didn't get to see him. She's being raised without a father. Mohammed's daughters are still very little.
This is Gaza. People leave and some arrive after them. The Israeli occupation and its allies could not stand the resilience of Gazans and their insistence on resisting the siege. The truth hit when the former Israeli Foreign Affairs Minister Tzipi Livni threatened with her famous words, "Enough means enough," to the situation in Gaza. This declaration of war did not come from Tel Aviv, but from Cairo, the capital of the Arab nation that scarified thousands of martyrs in several wars against the Israeli occupation for the sake of Palestine.
Hamas need to understand the situation in Gaza Strip, and Hamas control in Gaza Strip is an obstacle on the way of the Palestinians to create a state. Enough is enough.
مصر حذرت وحذرت على مدى فترة ممتدة ومن يراوغ في فهم هذا التحذير فعليه أن يتحمل مسؤولياته رئيس الوزراء الإسرائيلي تحدث بقوله عليكم أن تتوقفوا وإلا سوف نقوم بكذا وكذا ردا على ما هو الرد؟ ردا على عدم تجديد التهدئة إطلاق الصواريخ ليلة حضور ليفني إلى مصر أطلق 60 صاروخ.
The issues went beyond that when the Israeli TV channel 10 broadcast a report in which Egypt's Foreign Affairs Minister Ahmed Al-Ghit appeared while justifying the war on Gaza. Livni fulfilled her promise. The war in Gaza took place at the turn of 2009. The war that lasted for 22 days killed 1,500 Palestinians, mostly women, children, and elderly. Another 1,500 were injured, and the border did not open for them to get treatment, nor to allow the entry of medical supplies, which could have eased their pain.
It's a shame that the criminal terrorist Tzipi Livni stood in front of 80 million Egyptians in front of 300 million Arabs and said from an Egyptian platform, "I will declare war." From there, the war against the defenseless and besieged people of Gaza began. Arabs and Muslims getting murdered by white phosphorus and bombs dropped by F-16 warplanes. The American war machine crushed everything in Gaza. The Egyptian foreign minister at the time didn't say a word.
The wounds of Gaza did not even intercede from the conspiracies to destroy it. As Livni looked to Gazans again through the doors of Egypt, looking to implement an agreement signed in Washington between Livni and American Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in 2009, the most important term in the agreement was the construction of an underground steel wall on the Egyptian border with Gaza to cut the way for the tunnels. $1 billion was assigned for this project. It was the former Egyptian regime's responsibility to construct this steel wall, and indeed Egypt began mobilizing large machines to build this steel wall so that the siege of Gaza would become from above and below the ground.
The steel wall would go 30 meters deep in the ground, which meant anyone who had a tunnel with an entrance 25 meters deep would have to close it. So the steel wall halted almost all of our work. There was less goods and less tunnel work, hence the workers went out of business and less goods entered Gaza. Like I said, the wall would go down 30 meters, and if you went down another 50 to 30 meters, you'd hit water. So it completely shut off the lifeline between Gaza and Egypt.
The construction of the underground steel wall continued, and the Egyptian regime continued to crack down on Gaza in numerous ways, including blocking the return of luggage belonging to Hajj pilgrims and keeping their luggage held in Cairo Airport.
The goods procured in Egypt were piling up because they couldn't be transferred into Gaza. Egyptian guards would search the pilgrims' luggage. It was an awful scene. So the goods would either be destroyed or lost. The exceptional security circumstances in Egypt at the time also resulted in pilgrims losing their luggage or other belongings.
The pilgrims' luggage were held for about 5 months. Egypt refused entry of the pilgrims' luggage, citing that there weren't any security permissions nor checks. This was part of the siege policies imposed on Gaza. It was a disruption operation for moving pilgrims and travel needs.
Gaza continued to complain its misery and sadness to God until January 25, 2011, when the people of Egypt began their glorious revolution, where millions went out in the streets and squares in massive demonstrations and protests. Hundreds got killed and thousands injured at the hands of the Egyptian security apparatus that did not spare an effort to stop the revolution that lasted for 17 days and which in the end was crowned with the announcement of the stepping down of a leader that ruled for 3 decades.
In the name of the forgiving, merciful God, ladies and gentlemen, in these difficult circumstances our nation is experiencing, the President Hosni Mubarak has decided to step down from the Republic's presidency position and instructed the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces to manage the country's affairs. God bless you all.
The Mubarak regime fell and the people won and expressed their victory in celebrations that filled the streets of Egypt's towns and villages. The same situation was reflected on the people of Gaza, who predicted good from Egypt and its people.
The Egyptian revolutionaries kept Gaza in mind. They used to shout in the name of Palestine and Gaza in Tahrir Square and against the president who had laid siege to it. When the revolution succeeded, we thought all the Zionist threats against Gaza would be countered by Egyptians protesting outside the Zionist embassy. Later, the Rafah border crossing reopened. It was the work of the brotherly religious and strategic relations between Palestine and Egypt.
Of course, now we cross with respect and without questions. They don't even ask for the university papers. It was enough for me to write that I was traveling to study. There were no problems. Even inside Egypt, we started to say we were Palestinians with pride and glory. Thank God.
Regarding the tunnels, the situation has changed dramatically. In fact, there's been a sea change. All the former regime loyalists are gone. The Americans are gone. The Europeans are gone. They're all gone from the border. And now the tunnels are running again.
In this way, Abd Allah entered Egypt safely. Maybe he will recover from his illness, just like Egypt recovered from the former regime.
When the revolution happened in Egypt, my health improved a lot and made things a lot easier for me. On June 8, 2011, I traveled to Egypt and stayed there for 25 days getting treatment in Mahed Nasser Hospital. I was so glad when I sat with the youth of the revolution and talked. I felt we belonged to the same place and felt the same way.